Well, thanks, Jim, and it's great to be back here in Greenbelt, which I used to come to for many years. This talk is titled, I think, Bill Gates, Bono and You, and I'm going to start with a bit about Bono and me. There's not a lot to tell, but I'll tell it. He is a man who, after all, I've not actually met, but I have had a pee alongside one day. I walked out of the loo, and there was all these cameras waiting to poise to take photographs, and I didn't know what was going on. And they said, did you not see Bono in there with you? And I said, oh, no. They said, there's a short guy next to me, I said. Well, it turned out it was him, and I didn't realize how short he was. Anyway, I did eventually get to speak to him, interview him for this book that I'm going to base my talk on, which, as Jim mentioned, is called Philanthrocapitalism, which is co-authored with Michael Green, who is somewhere in here over there. I used to come to Greenbelt. In fact, the year I first came to Greenbelt was the year after U2 played here. They played here in 1982, I think. I came for the first time in 1983. And every year that I came, we used to spend a large amount of time pursuing rumors that Bono had been sighted around the site and that he was going to make a spontaneous performance. And in fact, he is coming along later to discuss the book with you. But later, when I was interviewing him, which I was doing by phone, I actually thought I'd killed him. I was talking away about his new brand, Red, that he'd launched, which you see on the T-shirts and phones and all American Express cards and all those things. And he said, hang on a minute, I'm driving around, there's a lorry. And suddenly the phone went dead. And I thought, oh no, what's happened? And fortunately, about 5 minutes later, the phone rang again, and it was, oh yeah, sorry, I'm in Dublin, I got lost. I don't think he goes there that often. And he said, and I'm a terrible driver. And so fortunately, I hadn't killed him. But he was, I think from the first time I was at Greenbelt, he was someone who I looked to as an inspiration, as someone well known that, you know, I could follow their journey, who was more interesting than Cliff Richard, which was very important at that time as you were growing up. And he had, you know, I think songs like Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For very much kind of spoke to where I and my friends were at that time, trying to figure out what life was all about and doing it through the lens of Christianity. And so it was interesting as life went on. I became a journalist, started writing about business and finance and so forth, that he started cropping up again in my life. That he, you know, I was writing about the aid and trade issue around the G8 summit in Gleneagles in 2005. And there he was, organizing the campaigns and so forth, the front man for all that Make Poverty History campaign. And I started to discover Mike actually worked for Department for International Development at the time. He was telling me some of the backstory to how that whole event was organized and how a mass movement was brought in to put pressure on government. And in fact, government played a key role working with celebrities like Bono and indeed foundations, big philanthropists like Bill Gates, to actually make the whole thing happen. And it just seemed like an absolutely fascinating subject. How does the world work in that way? How is policy that has a potential impact on millions and millions of lives, how is policy made? How is it changed? How do these celebrities and outsiders work with politicians, work with business, work with non-profits and civil society to make change happen? I had first interviewed Bill Gates in 2001 when I was doing a long article about all this new wealth that was created during the first internet period and the technology revolution and how it was affecting people, because it had always interested me, not being wealthy, you know, what getting all that money all of a sudden would do to you. And what was very striking to me when I met him was that he was clearly much more interested in talking about giving money away and how that was fulfilling to him and how he could actually make a real difference to hundreds of millions of lives than he was in talking about how he'd made the money or any other aspect of his life. It was fascinating that he the passion. And I went away from that interview feeling this is not just a plaything of the rich, this isn't just a tokenism, not in every case at least, but there are some people out there who are, you know, very serious about this and can do things in ways that ordinary politics and the mass movements that I'd grown up supporting and being involved with do things that they couldn't do. And so I then discovered, you know, reading about it in the press that, sorry, you can't hear me, talking to myself again. I then discovered that, you know, in fact, Bono and his organization, at the time called Data, but now called One, you know, had actually been founded by going to people like Bill Gates and George Soros, who is a billionaire hedge fund manager, and actually asking for money to create a proper professional organization. Gates said to him, how much do you need to start this organization? He said, about $3 million. Gates said, I'll put up $1 million if you can find two other people to put up the other $2 million. And he did that. He went away and got George Soros and another guy called Ed Scott to put up the money. They hired a staff. They set a professional organization up. They started working simultaneously on creating a mass movement or working with nonprofits to build the Make Poverty History campaign and on lobbying inside Washington, inside London, and really combining those two activities in a way that had not really ever been done in the sort of professional, well-funded way that they'd done it before. So that brought you to the 2005 Make Poverty History campaign, the Glen Eagles Summit, the big promises made by the world leaders at that point. In 2006, I was lucky enough to be invited along to cover an announcement by Warren Buffett, who is an investor who at that time was the second richest man in the world, in the New York Public Library. And Buffett got up on stage and said, I'm going to give away almost all of my money. I'm going to give away $1 billion each to my three children, to their foundations, their charitable foundations, not for their own personal use. And I'm going to give away $1 billion to the foundation that was established by my late wife. And I'm going to give away the rest to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which then became the biggest charitable foundation in the world, reckoned to have, if you count all Buffett's money, probably assets of about $60 billion to give away. And to me, this was an extraordinary moment, and it's where we start the book, because you had the two most successful businessmen of their age, possibly the two most successful businessmen ever, standing on stage and promising to give away most of their money. And this, if I put it bluntly, was not my standard image of capitalists. This was not how I thought rich people behaved. It really challenged me, and it challenged Mike, and we went away and said we should write a book about this and try and analyze it. Why is this happening? How much are they the exceptions or the norm? To what extent do the rest of us, how do we engage with these people? Do we want them to succeed? Do we think this means we should just tax them a lot more? Do we actually have a part to play in working together with them? And so we actually, you know, went out and talked to as many of the people who claimed to be philanthropists as we could find, you know, particularly the high-profile ones, people like you know, Branson here in Britain, who is a odd sort of philanthropist in that he is very good at embracing social causes and using his business to help them, but isn't very good at giving away his own money. And then there are people like the hedge fund people in Britain called Chris Cooper-Hone, who last year gave £1 billion to his foundation to give away. To people like Angelina Jolie and Shakira, who, you know, are not the standard celebrity philanthropists, but actually go about what they're doing in a very professional way, using their public image and brand to reach a much bigger audience than most people can reach, and then trying to channel it into real policy change. And so I really want to just talk a bit here before we go over to questions about, you know, what we found and what, you know, what we were left concluding after we studied and talked to a lot of the people who I think were very used to lots of headlines about their philanthropy, but weren't used to actually people going beyond the headline and saying, well, actually, how are you going about what you're doing? you know, how do you think about the political context of what you're doing? How do you make sure your money is well spent? I think the first point to make is that the philanthropists that we highlight in the book are people who are very serious about impact. They really want to make a difference. They're not content just to write a check and go to some fancy dinner and get photographed in the papers. They actually spend a lot of time saying, how do we measure the results one way or another of what we're doing? And that is leading them to kind of bring to bear on their giving the sort of mindset that made them successful in business. It's a much more strategic mindset than had traditionally been pursued by big philanthropists. It was about understanding how systems work, forming partnerships with people who had the ability to make a difference. They were, in particular, you know, keen to find... there's this concept called leverage, which in the financial world has now become a dirty word because it means borrowing lots of money to double up your bets. But in philanthropy, leverage means how do I take my money and achieve far more impact than it would normally achieve by thinking cleverly about how systems work. You talk to Bill Gates, and the first thing he says is, we've got a very tiny organization. So here's a man who is, with his wife, giving away maybe $60 billion over the rest of his life, and he regards that as a small amount of money. And the reason, and he's right, because if you look at how much governments spend, how much big business has at its disposal, the amounts of money he's handling and giving away are small. But in the world of social change, the amount of money he has is actually potentially able to have a huge impact, an outsized impact, because actually if you've got a great idea for changing the world, it's actually very difficult to get people willing to put any money behind it if there's no profit coming back at the end of the day. And so as a philanthropist, you're not having to account for how you spend your money by going to the electorate every few years. You're not having to explain to your shareholders, as you would do in a business, you know, how's this contributing to profit? And you're not like an ordinary charity or non-profit, constantly worrying about where the next dollar or pound is going to come from. You have this pot of money, and you can think as long-term as you like. You can think as controversially as you like. You can be completely out of the box. You can fund any cause that you want because you're accountable to no one except ultimately yourself. And that gives a tremendous freedom, a freedom to take risks, to back ideas that no one else will back. And that is where, you know, I think people like Gates and Bono are starting to produce very interesting alternatives to the traditional political way of changing the world. So a lot of you will be aware that there's a book out at the moment called Dead Aid by a Zambian economist called Dambisa Moyo, which basically says all aid is a waste of money. It's all makes Africa worse, more dependent, more dysfunctional than it was before. And then the response to that tends to be people like Jeff Sachs, the New York economist, who tends to say things like, just, you know, we don't spend enough money, let's spend more money on helping Africa. The philanthrocapitalists that we write in the book, I think, have a much more nuanced and, I think, more effective approach, which is to really, you know, figure out when aid works, when and how money that's given can combine with money that's motivated by profit, by how it can partner with business, how it can partner with government, how it can partner with non-profits to really deliver results. And so you see a much more complex world than the dead aid versus good aid. You see a discussion about what sort of aid is smart aid and who should provide that aid. And I think that's a very important discussion, and it's one that, you know, too often gets drowned out in the press, which is why one reason why we wanted to write about this phenomena, because I know certainly here most of you in this room will probably be committed to giving and to making a difference in places like Africa, and will, you know, be rightly concerned about how your money is being used and how to be as effective as possible. And it's important, I think, that we all know how the most effective players in this world are actually thinking at the moment and working, and that's one of the things we hope will come through in the book. Another important theme that we found talking to the philanthrocapitalists was that they really, because of this understanding that their money is relatively small compared to the money that governments and business have, is that they have started to focus a lot on how do you motivate public opinion. Because unless they can get public opinion behind their agenda, they're not going to succeed. And so that's where Bono and Gates became such an interesting partnership, because Bono had this ability to reach a large audience, and Gates had the ability to fund him. And, I think as someone that comes out of the British system where we, we're quite suspicious of the rich, more suspicious than the Americans are, that worried me quite a lot. What's the political, what do we think about wealthy people like this shaping our politics? Because we don't know what motivates them, they're not accountable, as I've just said. They are very ambitious. They really want to change things. I mean, Gates, if you look at the agenda that Bill Gates has, it is to, find cures for the 20 most deadly diseases in the world, which sounds like it can only be a good thing. But if you think about what that means, it really means changing governments all around the world and how they deliver healthcare services, as well as changing the agenda of pharmaceutical companies, and being very active in all sorts of parts of the world that are not well governed. And so, critics of Gates will say he's a new colonialist of some kind, and that this is, a real step backwards. And I think another reason why this is very important that we think about this subject is that it is going to change our politics. It's going to change how we as a society work. And, we need to debate that and create a social contract of some kind that allows this to happen, if we want it to happen, or finds a better alternative if there is one. I happen to think that people like Gates are able to do things that no one else can, which are good things, and that we need to find a way to make that a politically unthreatening and, in fact, positive thing rather than an undermining thing. But it's something we need to debate, and we need to get the social contract right. Now, Mike and I came up with what we call, sort of jokingly, the Good Billionaire's Guide, to try and help figure out how the rich should behave for us to feel approvingly towards them. And that we say, firstly, they should make their money legitimately without exploiting people. So that rules out a lot of Russian billionaires, for example, but there are others. Secondly, that they should pay a reasonable amount of taxation. Thirdly, they should give away a larger part of their money than the rest of us. And fourthly, they should make serious efforts to make sure the money is given away effectively and accountably rather than in ways that are just done thoughtlessly. And we offer that as a basis for a debate about, is that the right terms of engagement between the rest of us and the rich, that if they do those things, that we will celebrate their good fortune and wealth rather than regard them as inevitably doomed, as I guess a reading of the Bible might say they are. We've just written the paperback edition of the book, and we've added a chapter because lots been happening in the last year or so since we wrote the original, not least that capitalism has come crashing down, which has made some of the rich less rich than they were before. Although, interestingly, I don't think that's true of many of the capitalists that we feature in the book, who are certainly going to be remain very, very wealthy, able to give away a lot of money, and will continue to do so. But secondly, because we wrote this extra chapter because what is happening because of the internet and a better understanding of social networking is that many of the advantages that the super rich have when they give are now becoming available to all of us as we give. So you talk to Gates, and Gates wants, I want to know exactly where my money is going. I want to know Is the money making a difference? And ideally, I want to get feedback from the people I'm giving to that allows me to know that I'm doing the right thing with the money and that it really is working. And in America, the Barack Obama election campaign brought a lot of people from the internet world into thinking about how do you motivate and mobilize mass movements using that technology. And those people are now increasingly focusing on how do you change social causes that aren't about getting someone elected president, but are about making a difference in the developing world or solving any other number of other political problems or social problems. And so this is not entirely new, but the organizations that are doing this are now growing very fast. I'm sure some of you will know of Kiva.org, which is a website which allows individuals to lend as little as £20, £10 to a small entrepreneur in Africa or in Asia. The person who wants the loan posts their details on the website, and you, as a lender, choose who you're lending to. You will get the tangible feedback, usually, of the money being repaid. And you will also hear the stories of the person that you're lending to. In some ways, this is an old charitable model. Barnardo's, famously used to show pictures of children before and after that they'd helped, and in fact ended up faking some of those pictures because it was such an effective fundraising technique. But today, because of the internet and the feedback loops that are possible there, actually you are getting much more serious engagement going on. It's not just a picture. It's not just sending off a letter into space. It's real dynamic interaction. And it's also fostering communities around giving that are quite different to what was happening before. You now get teams on Kiva who compete to outlend each other, for example. So you'll be glad to know that the Kiva Christians are beating the Kiva atheists by some margin at the moment, although it's a competition that comes and goes. The Kiva Obama community beat the Kiva McCain community quite well last year. But around this is a whole dialogue. It's building up of people who are sharing the cause and thinking about ways to operate. And increasingly, Kiva is now beginning to, the people who run Kiva are now trying to think about how do we use this community that we've built up to impact on political discussions, so that if there's a vote in Congress, for example, on a development-related issue, you can notify the Kiva community, and they will all call up their congressman or whatever, make a point. So there's starting to be a lot more dynamic campaigning. You're able to move much faster than in a traditional campaign and make a real difference. Now, what's interesting is that beyond that is that you're now seeing some of the big foundations like Bill Gates. Bill Gates has said to people, to some of the organizations around the causes that he is concerned about. There's one called Donors Choose in America, which is about teachers who have non-core projects that they want funded, posting those projects on the website, and people can lend donate the money to help those things happen. Gates is now allocating some of the money he puts towards education reform in America through a partnership with Donors Choose, so that ordinary people giving will determine where some of Gates's money goes, which I think is, again, a very positive development about how we build that relationship between the wealthy givers and the rest of us in a way that doesn't threaten to destabilize our politics too much. This is all in its infancy, I believe, but I think we are going to see a very constructive partnership between some of those big foundations and the internet-based social activism world, which has the potential to really transform the effectiveness of giving, because, you know, I think all of us feel the frustration that when you give money to a charity or a cause, it's either you either get the personal engagement, in which case it's probably on a very small scale project that you don't really feel, you know, is this really going to make a big difference, or it's giving into a big organisation that doesn't really give you any feedback and you don't know where the money's going. So, in concluding, and I want to throw it open to you really to ask questions and challenge and whatever, you know, this phenomena of people like Bill Gates, celebrities like Bono, actually getting involved in trying to solve some of the world's biggest problems, it's a real movement. It's a movement that is still going strong despite the crisis of the past year in the economy. In fact, if anything, it's more powerful now because other resources are more constrained and, you know, other, you know, government money is not going to be as available as their money would be. That movement really needs to be understood and debated with, but it needs to be welcomed too, because I think it does have the power to solve problems. You know, I do believe that malaria, which is one of the biggest killers of children in particular in the developing world, you know, will be actually eradicated over the next 20 years because of the efforts of people like Gates and Bono and others to revive a campaign that had been tried before but failed. I think they will succeed, and I think they'll succeed on a number of other fronts. And therefore, it is a good development, but it's a development that needs to be understood, and we need to partner with it. And we need to figure out how do we use our own organisations, how do we create new social communities online and in the flesh that actually make us effective partners, actually make sure that they tap into our ideas and make them, you know, their approach is democratically accountable. And if we do that, I think we can actually achieve what one of these philanthropists described to me as a productivity miracle in the world, in the business of changing the world. That compared to business, you know, social change is actually a lot less efficient and effective, but what's happening now has the potential to change that, and we really can build a far better world over the next 20 years or so by engaging with this and taking it seriously. And so on that note, I really just want to encourage you to, read the book, but also to to debate and talk about these issues as much as possible, and to think ultimately constructively about how we make this work, rather than, as is so often the case, just simply writing the rich off as as a irrelevancy or something worse. So thank you very much. I think we have a roving mic. Would anyone like to ask a question? We've got someone over there on the front.
In your discussions with these various people, what level of kind of critical reflection did you find coming back from them about the capitalist structures that had given them their wealth in the first place? And also, as a step on from that, in the economic structures that they were complicit in a sense building in the developing world through their engagement with its activity, you know, in the future development of capitalism and its spread outwards.
Yeah, I mean, I think not many of the ones that we talk to blame themselves for the problems of the world. I mean, I think if you went back 100 years to some of the first great American philanthropists, the Andrew Carnegies of the world, who, you know, were building big companies by driving people off the land and undermining the trade unions and all that kind of thing, there was an element of guilt in their giving. Talking to Bill Gates, there's no sense of guilt. He doesn't believe, you know, whatever the evidence is on Windows, that he's a monopolist. He thinks he's made the money legitimately, and the world, a world that becomes more like the American economy, like the European economy, you know, will be a world that is better off for everybody. So there's no sense of shame behind his giving. I don't think there is even behind George Soros. I think he would regard the fact that he made £1 billion in a day driving the pound out of the ERM in 1992, he regards that as doing Britain a favour rather than being exploitative or whatever, and maybe he's right. But there isn't that sense. I mean, I think that the issues get more difficult when you're talking about philanthropists coming out of some of the developing countries. I mean, you take the richest Mexican in the world, Carlos Slim, who's really made a lot of money by charging people too much for their telephones. You know, you sense that he doesn't really want to get into a discussion of why he's doing philanthropy now he's doing it. I'm sure the issue is also true for some of the Russians who are now doing philanthropy and who probably made most of their money by stealing assets from the state. So these things are, you know, mixed up. I think ultimately the best philanthropists do believe in a market economy, and they believe that what Africa, for example, needs is a functioning market economy. It's interesting that the first African billionaire philanthropist is a guy called Mo Ibrahim, who made his money providing mobile phones to across Africa, and which, as many of you will know, has been a major driver of development in Africa, as lots of people have been able to connect with each other efficiently for the first time. He has set up a foundation in Africa that is really focused on improving the governance of Africa, because he believes that one of the biggest problems to Africa standing on its own two feet and earning a living through business is that its governments are so corrupt. And so he has an annual prize for the retired African leader who did the best job in office. And it's $3.5 million plus an annual pension of, you know, $500,000 a year. So it's not a trivial amount. And it's stimulating a whole debate in Africa about what is good government and how to improve it. But he's also investing in job creation in Africa as well. So they do come from that world of believing... Nice. I think that must mean there's another question needed. Over on the front there.
Hi, Matt, I'm over here. My question is, how important is it for this whole vision of philanthropy stroke capitalism to become a mass movement? Because I'm certainly, for example, I can see Christian organizations starting to embrace it. There's an organization called the Transformation Business Network, and they help SMEs as well as large organizations to do business with Africa, because ultimately the only sustainable way that Africa and the developing world is going to cut its dependency on charity is to trade its way out. And certainly I can see a lot of new generation entrepreneurs that are possibly not as well known as Bill Gates and Warren Buffett that have got very similar vision. And there is possibly a great role here for Christians to embrace this.
Yeah, there's a number of different points there. I mean, I think one is that, you know, I think this is something that you don't have to be rich to do this. As I was saying, I think this whole philanthrocapitalism thing is going mass market. And that's a good thing. I do think one problem in the past with non-profits has been that there are just too many of them and too many people doing exactly the same thing as each other. And there's, unlike in business, if you do that, the best compete, they compete, and the best emerge as winners and the bad ones go out of business. In the world of doing good, that tends not to happen. And so one of the things that needs to happen is to have a much greater transparency about all the different things that are going on, and a real determination to make sure that, you know, the best get as big as they can and remain effective, while the worst, you know, don't waste resources, because the money is so precious that, you know, you don't want to waste it. So there's some important questions to be asked when you start an organization, which is, you know, am I just really creating kind of a wasteful way of solving something, whereas in fact I could be partnering with other people who are already doing this and helping together make a much better organization. As for Christians, I mean, it is interesting, I think, how the church is both at the individual level and at the high level becoming more involved in partnering with the philanthrocapitalists, the big philanthrocapitalists. One of the ones we write about in the book, one of the leaders we write about in the book is Rick Warren, the author of Purpose Driven Life, which is probably the best-selling book other than the Bible on religion in the last 10 years. And he is now part of this initiative to eradicate malaria, the Malaria No More campaign, because ultimately, he says, the church on the ground, and indeed the temples and the mosques and so forth, are in some ways the most effective organizations at making sure that when bed nets and ultimately malaria virus vaccines become available and delivered down to the local community, that they actually get used for their proper purpose and you get real results. And so I think, you know, Warren is right to say the church actually has a lot of assets that it can give and actually use more effectively in partnership with other organizations rather than to be just ghettoized as doing a church-based approach only. So I think there's lots of, you know, we're in the early days again of figuring out how we can all work together and make this, make the sum of the parts bigger than the individual parts. Next question, over here.
Matthew, how do you avoid, or can you avoid, this movement becoming just a patronization of the poor rather than actually empowering the poor and disadvantaged, believing they might have the answers to their own difficulties?
Yeah, I think this is always the, you know, perhaps the biggest challenge of any attempt to help people who are not as lucky as you are. And I think, you know, there is a real challenge that, you know, someone like Gates, you know, probably all he ever experiences, and Bono, it'd be the same for Bono, whenever they go anywhere to visit a village or a project or whatever, they will be sucked up to. They'll be given the most favourable treatment possible. I think they're very similar. I think it's the Queen who famously said, "How is it wherever I go, I can always smell fresh paint?" And I think the same would be true of Bono or any of these leaders. And so, fundamentally, that how we really help people in ways that make them feel a greater sense of personal dignity and so forth is one of the huge challenges. And, you know, I do think that one of the developments that has been going on, because people like Gates want to know, is my money making a difference? They are aware that people lie to them and suck up to them the whole time. So they're trying to create systems that bypass that process, more independent analysis. Ultimately, I think that things like the mobile phone revolution and some of the new software that's coming out, which allows the people who are in African villages to actually say what they think and communicate that back up very quickly, you know, has the potential to create a much greater bottom-up context in which people are giving and intervening that could, you know, deal with some of that problem of being patronized, because people feel much better when their voice is heard, quite rightly so. And this will make it harder for people to sit in their big offices and believe they're making a difference that people want when they're not. So I'm quite optimistic about that. Someone down the front here.
What concerns me is the, for the want of a better word, cultural imperialism that lies behind these philanthrocapitalists, who seem to subscribe to the idea that there are two kinds of people in the world, Americans and those who want to be Americans. It particularly shows in their attitude to Latin America, where there is a decided push to make that country give up its cultural identity, to stop speaking Spanish and adopt American English, to embrace American evangelical Christianity in place of the Catholicism that's been traditional in South America. And people say, well, all right, these are third world countries. Well, no, they're not always. Maybe true of the northern two-thirds of South America, but the three countries of the Southern Cone, which I know intimately, Uruguay, Argentina and Chile, are not third world by any stretch of the imagination. They're more like Southern Europe than South America. They have their problems, but they'll say, we can solve them ourselves, thank you very much, and we don't need to become dependent territories of the United States like Puerto Rico or American Samoa in order to do so. What do you say to people like that?
Well, I suppose I've yet to meet myself a philanthropist that's trying to drive Spanish... Was that me or you? That's one of the things. Anyway, I've yet to meet a philanthropist that is trying to drive Spanish out of Latin America, and replace it with English, I have to say. But I did happen to be in Mexico when Shakira was launching her Latin American organization called Alas, which means wings, which is a kind of Live Aid meets Bono's organization meets something entirely new. It's a series of artists in Latin America who are using their brands to launch a public campaign, combined with billionaire business people like Carlos Slim, companies like Coca-Cola and Microsoft, and this American philanthropist called Howard Buffett, who is the son of Warren Buffett, who is one of the guys who got the $1 billion to his foundation, who was given $100 million to sort of kickstart this campaign. And who describes himself as a Mexican trapped in an American body, for what it's worth. But he, this is very interesting because it is Latin American leaders, young leaders. So Shakira's in, I guess, maybe 30 now. She's been a philanthropist since she was 21, because her country, Colombia, has a lot of refugee crises, problems because of the Marxist terrorists and the drug trade between them, that she has an organization. This organization's mission is to put the care of children under five and mothers on the political agenda in Latin America. That is the kind of leadership that Latin America's traditional patriarchal culture has not given a high place to. And so I personally see that as a domestic phenomena that's learning from some of the things that are going on in the outside world. It's not about an Americanization. In fact, Shakira is very adamant. This is not just us trying to be Bono. It's us trying to do it our way because we care about Latin America. And you see, as I say, the similar things happening in Africa, similar things happening in India. I interviewed Jet Li, who is the film star who some of you remember from The Mummy's Tomb. But he nearly drowned in the tsunami in Asia. He was pulled out of the water. As he says, the water was up to here. His daughter was washed away but rescued, he says, because they knew she was my daughter and I was famous, and so she was saved. And he went away determined to promote giving in China, which is not a country that has traditionally or in recent years really given that much of a place. He now has he's created an organization called One. He went to Gates for advice. He went to Bono for advice. They got McKinsey, the management consultant, to help design it. They got Accenture or Ernst & Young to audit it. It's based in Singapore because they have the best laws on making sure that charities are well governed. They use the internet. They use mobile phones. They use credit cards to give. He now has 1 million Chinese giving one yuan a month because he says everyone, whether you're a rich guy or a poor person, you can afford to give one yuan a month. And that is now really starting a culture of giving in China for the first time in decades. So, I think that although, a lot of the best-known philanthropists today are Americans, it is a global phenomenon. And indeed, it started out as a global phenomenon. One of the things that Mike and I have great fun with in America is pointing out that they didn't, in fact, invent philanthropy, that it, in fact, flowered most in Britain. First of all, in the first Elizabethan period, where some of the schools and hospitals were invented by philanthropists. In the Victorian period, the whole anti-slavery movement of Wilberforce was funded by bankers in London. This almost seems to be a recurring feature of capitalism and economic growth, is that when people do become wealthy because they're innovative and entrepreneurial, many, although not all of those people, don't become like Scrooge. They actually want to make a difference and often come back with quite inventive solutions to society's problems, working in partnership with those who don't have money but have ideas. So I think this is a global thing that's the product of actually humans being surprisingly, caring about each other. There was another question somewhere at the back there.
Hello? Sorry. Sorry, this is probably going to come out more of a stream of thoughts. But you were talking about the lack of accountability, and so it's fine when they're doing the things we like them doing. But as you say, 60 billion isn't very much when you consider that DFID has a budget of 8 billion per year. But actually, 60 billion would be a huge amount to the BNP. And so how do you, A, go about creating that contract that you talk of? And B, how do you engage these people without just becoming another problem in the jigsaw? You know, you're talking again about the third sector having issues with often not taking best practice from business, especially with regards to mergers and acquisitions. How do you bring all these parts together, and what is the basis of the contract that you want?
Yeah, I think those are good questions, and I think what's happening at the moment is that people are increasingly asking those questions and trying to gather groups together to talk about them. And one of the conferences I went to earlier in the year was organized by a group called New Philanthropy Capital, which basically has a series of research initiatives to look at different sectors where charities are operating and to say, okay, which are the charities here that, if you've got money to give, you're going to get the highest kind of social return on your money. And they organized this conference to launch something called the Association of Nonprofit Analysts, which is going to be an international group. They got about 300 people from all over the world who are doing similar things, which is about trying to figure out how do we analyze the performance of charities and nonprofits. And, you know, I think out of that association will come a more and more informed debate. Certainly in the media, we've noticed in the last couple of years that the tone of the coverage has moved from just being, oh, look, Bill Gates has given away another 100 billion or something, to what's he actually doing with the money? Is the money being well used? And so I think the media is much more engaged in challenging these wealthy philanthropists, and increasingly I think they feel they need to engage back because I think they do understand that if they can't get public opinion behind them, if you're trying to do what Bill Gates is trying to do, you have no hope unless you can get government money and government resources behind some of the ideas that you fund. So they have to engage with the public, and they have to find a way to make it work. So I think that that there is a lot of momentum behind this process of trying to debate what the social contract is. I just think it's still happening at the moment amongst a relatively small elite group and needs to go much further than that. You know, I wish Bono would talk about this stuff rather than just doing the headline, give more money or whatever. It needs to be, I'd love him to talk about how he, what he thinks about business, for example, why he regards himself as a card-carrying capitalist, why he relocated you two from Ireland to Holland for tax reasons, and yet regards that as okay at the same time that he is calling on governments to give a lot more money to aid. But so far those discussions happen away from the public arena, and I think the goal of our book is to say move this stuff into the public arena and let's have a much more broad debate, because these issues are so important and what they're doing is so important that if it isn't grounded in accountability, then it may all go horribly wrong and all this money and great ideas will go to waste. Was there another? Someone at the front there?
Okay. Matthew, you've begun to... you talked about Bono relocating U2's financial headquarters to Holland and moving away from Bono, but back to the likes of Bill Gates and so on. I guess my difficulty comes back to one of the first questions, which was about to what extent the philanthropists have any critical engagement with how they've actually accumulated the millions and billions that they've got. And also, I guess, to what extent we collude with that, with the idea of there being ill-gotten gains, by embracing philanthrocapitalism. I'm old enough to remember when Margaret Thatcher came in, and a lot of what you've said sounds to me like let the wealthy get more wealthy because of the trickle-down effect. And actually, the risk of what's being done here is actually that we collude with the big problem, which is multinationals who gain their money largely by creating poverty in a lot of areas. Now, great that the philanthropists who have benefited from that should give away some of their money, but it doesn't. If there isn't a feedback loop into ethical practice within the likes of Dow Chemical and Microsoft and the like, then actually we'll still be talking about a small pool of money.
Yeah, I mean, I think the multinationals point is very interesting because, you know, you roll back to the Thatcher period, if you can bear to, and it was, you know, this defense of capitalism was so... It was like anything that, if a company tried to help anybody, it was almost betraying Thatcherism or something, betraying capitalism. And a lot of companies just wouldn't engage with... You know, so if you were Nike, you would not engage with the fact that, you know, you were exploiting workers in the developing world. And I think that what's happened over the last 10 years in particular has been that a whole group of people who grew up in the age of Live Aid and so forth, and who do actually see themselves as global citizens, and who do think about business in a much more broad-minded way, have understood that that was, you know, deeply destructive behaviour, not just for society, but actually for their own profitability, which in some ways is the thing that keeps them most awake at night. So if you're Nike, you understand that it did terrible damage to your brand to have people constantly cite you as an example of the worst possible practice. You know, because ultimately, as the world gets richer and you've got all these people buying your shoes, are you going to buy shoes from a company whose labour practices make you feel uncomfortable? Well, probably if there's another company that makes almost as good shoes or just as good shoes that doesn't exploit people, well, you're going to feel better about yourself buying the other pair of shoes. And so they now are... You know, they've got these amazing partnerships with non-profit organisations who their factories in the developing world are visited probably more by non-profits than any factories in the world. And, you know, although they occasionally slip up, when they're discovered doing so, they are responding very, very quickly. So they're now held up as best practice in many ways. A lot of other companies are beginning to understand that, you know, they want to see themselves grow and last for many decades to come, and that they see that most of their growth is going to come from the developing world. And they don't want to be on the wrong side of history, because fundamentally, even if you're in a country that at the moment is badly governed by some dictator and he'll give you a deal, that in 10 years' time that dictator may well be gone and a democratic society will be in place that aren't going to let you carry on if you've behaved badly before. So the discussions in company boardrooms today are fundamentally different, at least in the best companies, than they were a decade ago, because they are thinking much more about, okay, what's the long-term strategy? And often the long-term strategy is going to be on the side of progress and building better societies than it is on, you know, kind of maximizing your short-term gains. So I think, you know, one of the things that Bill Gates and Buffett, by giving their money away so publicly, are doing is challenging that mindset, the Thatcherite mindset that business people just have to be selfish. But it's part of an overall change in mentality that has still, you know, got a long way to go, but I think is going to mean that actually we can look at multinationals more and more for the assets that they bring in changing the world, which is that they are extremely efficient organizations with massive networks of people across borders. So, and therefore, that if you can partner with them, you can actually, as a social change organization, achieve some fantastic results that you couldn't achieve on your own or working with government. So a number of companies like TNT, which is a kind of delivery express mail company, is now very much involved with the UN on emergency relief work, so that if there's a hurricane or an earthquake or a flood in parts of the world, it mobilizes its resources, its network, its supply chain to get stuff in to the people who need it most and can do it much better than governments can do. So the hope again is that part of this debate going forward will be how do we, what is it that companies, multinationals can do better than the rest of us, and how do we harness that to building a better world rather than just simply saying black and white, multinationals are bad, non-profits are good. So I hope, I hope that isn't the world of Margaret Thatcher. I hope that's a world which is a much better place to live in. There was someone else at the front row. Okay.
There was. You've touched on some of the answer to what I was going to ask, but I want to play devil's advocate slightly. I notice a lot of the questions seem to be working on the assumption that philanthropic capitalism is somehow a more suspect and inferior form, inferior way of helping developing countries, people in need, than the ordinary world of the Christian aids and the pressure groups and the tier funds and so on. And I want to turn it on its head and say, are there any ways in which you think that the fact that philanthropic capitalism doesn't have a problem with the breadhead world of globalization and global capitalism means it's got some things that it can teach to those other organizations in how it runs its affairs?
Well, yeah, that's very much the thrust of what we're saying, is that I think that these business people do bring, a perspective based on success about getting things done. So, the people who created Google are now philanthropists. So they have, in fact, designed the company to have a division of the company called Google.org, which is a philanthropic arm of their business, because they have essentially, in 10 years, gone from having no business to having a business that everyone knows, that almost everyone on the planet has heard of, or a large percentage of the population of the planet. They are used to thinking in terms of dramatic change and dramatic success, and they're bringing that mentality to their giving, and it really does shake up the world of traditional charity and non-profit, which I think is more accustomed to feeling it doesn't succeed or it succeeds in tiny steps. And this coming together of that attitude, those two attitudes, is often a culture shock for both sides. Now, it's amazing how many people for non-profits and the philanthropists that I talk to who just say they don't get it. They don't get it at all. Who do these business people think they are coming to tell us how to do what we're doing? And the other side, what are these people? They're so process orientated. They're not thinking the big picture. They're not understanding the possibilities. But what we're seeing now is that over time, those conversations are getting more constructive, that a mutual respect in the best cases is building up. And you really are starting to see organizations. I mean, the one I know best is Save the Children, which has seen a dramatic increase in the number of projects that it does that are funded by these mega philanthropists. And they are changing the way they work, and they are coming out with business plans that will explain what their strategy is. Because, frankly, a lot of these organizations are not used to being able to think 5 or 10 years ahead, because all they can think about is how do we get enough money to get us to the end of this project, which may last a year or two. And so there's an organization called Omidyar Networks, which was set up by Pierre Omidyar, who founded eBay. And they are going around actually finding organizations they really like, nonprofits they really like, and saying, here, have 10 million over 5 years and hire some better people to run the head office. And this is like a shocking thought to the nonprofit world, because you're really not allowed to do that. That's all overhead in the traditional language of non-profit. And now, it's in the business world, hiring the best people is called human capital. And so that change alone could really be the basis of far more effective non-profits and far more impressive social change if it happens. But there is this mistrust at first, I think, on both sides, that's obviously causing a lot of problems in certain situations.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to finish on that note. And as somebody who works for Christian Aid, I won't make any comment at all. Thank you very much indeed.
Can I just say two things very quickly? One is we have a website where we blog reasonably often, and it's called www.philanthrocapitalism.net. Someone bought .com and is now selling used cars on it or something, but it's .net. And I Twitter or tweet or whatever. My Twitter name is at Matt Bish, M-A-T-T-B-I-S-H. And do feel, I always say, don't, I feel strange saying follow me, but I mean, do feel free to do so. But thank you very much.